You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Have you ever wondered what the New York metropolitan area was like before it was developed, when it was still a wilderness? It had over 60 different ecosystems. Most of them are gone now, and the symbiotic relationship that exists between plants, insects, and animals in the natural world is being disrupted by non-native species that have been brought into the area ever since Europeans began settling here. What does it all mean for the home gardener? Well, joining us now are Gerard Lordahl, the Director of Open Space Greening Program at Grow NYC, and Pete Morosky, the founder and owner of Native Landscapes Incorporated of Pawling, New York. Welcome back, both of you.
Good to be here.
And we will be taking calls from listeners about plants, the transition into summer, or any other troublesome things. You can reach us at 212-433-9692. You can also write into our show page at wmyc.org/Lopate, or send us a tweet where our handle is @LeonardLopate. You'll also find us on Facebook. So, Pete, don't we live in one of the most diverse temperate zones on the planet? What did Manhattan look like when the Dutch arrived?
Well, it was an interesting concept, Leonard. You look at Brooklyn, for instance, and the reason why they called it Brooklyn is because there were a bunch of brooks running through the borough of Brooklyn, and early trappers tell stories about trapping beaver 40, 50, and 60 pounds. And then you look at Manhattan. Manhattan has 60-plus ecosystems, everything from floodplains to upland forests. And then you jump over the river and look over into New Jersey, the great swamp over there, the Meadowlands, which is a great resting, migrating area for wild birds. And there's waterfowl. It's half salt water. It's half fresh water. And then you get up into the Hudson Valley and over into New Jersey and into the Poconos and up into the Litchfield Hills. And this is where the real wilderness was. There were moose, there were elk, there were bear, there were mountain lion. And you even go up further, up by Albany, between Albany and Buffalo, there used to be the eastern buffalo that roamed this area in New York. I mean, it was a real mountain wilderness, and you're right. This is one of the most diverse temperate zones on the planet.
I'm not sorry that we don't have moose and well, other things roaming around. And it's obvious that you had to do something if you were going to put buildings on Manhattan. But we still have streams that are that sometimes flood the subways, don't they, Gerard? Mm-hmm.
And the Lower East Side, you know, has tributaries underground that you hit. And many of the community gardens, when they do digging, it's not far before you hit water. But, you know, there's campaigns all over the city now. It's just on the subway coming up here, and there are big subway posters about the wildlife and how New Yorkers have to learn to live with the deer and the possum. They're kind of coming back now. There are hawks in Prospect Park that I see on a regular basis. Community gardens
are flourishing.
Should
people worry about their dogs when hawks come by?
I'm not worried. I think, you know, I love seeing it. But, you know, gardens and parks, it's making the city more like what it was, you know, when Hudson was around, and the beauty of that, you know, and
But as I mentioned, things have changed. How can you tell if something is indigenous or is non-native?
Well, it's all about, like I said last time, Leonard, observation and learning about how these native plants exist, and getting back, becoming a naturalist, and getting back into the woods and seeing how a lot of this stuff works together in this whole symbiotic relationship between plants, animals, and bugs. And observe it, and the right plant in the right location, and you bring mm-hmm. all this stuff together, and wildlife starts to come back to an area.
Wait, when you say wildlife, you mean birds and insects?
Birds, insects, animals. You look at pictures, Leonard.
You want deer in Brooklyn?
Sure. Well, there's deer in Staten Island. There's mm-hmm. there's turkey over in Staten Island. There's falcons in New York. I mean, all this wildlife is coming back. And it's coming back because native plants are coming back. You look at pictures of the lower Hudson Valley and over in Pennsylvania and the Litchfield Hills over 100 years ago. You could count the trees in the landscape. And that's because it all went over to dairy farms. But now that the wilderness has come back, so have the bear, so have the coyotes, so have the turkey, so have the moose, Leonard. There's moose now as far south as northwest Connecticut, and they're working their way down. And you know what? There's been some mountain lion or cougar spotted in the region.
That would scare us.
Now, Gerard, there are very popular plants like white clover, Queen Anne's lace, dandelions. They're not indigenous. Does that matter?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We appreciate native plants, and it's all about maintenance and survival. And as Pete knows, you know, natives typically are better survivalists, if you would, in the garden, because according to people like Pete, if there's the original soil and the conditions, the plants would do better. Unfortunately, we have brought in a lot of exotic species that are planted around our home, that are in our community gardens, that are sold at the box stores and at the garden centers, and we're dealing with those plants as well. We try as much.
And don't they kind of take over in many cases? They always function like weeds?
Well, not always like weeds, but we like them. We like the showy azaleas. We like the magnolias that are exotic. So we have to have a balance of natives and exotics, I think, and community gardeners do that, backyard gardeners do that. It's a mix of exotics and natives.
But what happens when local insects, for example, come upon those plants? Don't they gravitate toward the ones that are part of our natural ecology?
I don't think the bees and the butterflies care whether they're exotic or native. If they've got the nectar and the pollen that they need to bring back to the hive, they're totally satisfied. So I think that's part of it.
Well, let's talk about bees a little bit. You know, the honeybees are native to Europe, where our bumblebees are native to this part of the world. And there's a big problem right now because of the amount of pesticides that we're putting into the landscape that a lot of our bumblebees are on the endangered species list. Now, there's a difference between how the European honeybee and the native bumblebee pollinate a lot of our flowers.
But we rely on them to pollinate our flowers, our vegetables, our fruit.
That's right.
Fruit.
And one of the reasons why they're just as good as if not better is because they can tolerate the colder weather that we have here on the East Coast. They can go up to higher elevations, and they can pollinate stuff that lives up there. And they're also buzz pollinators, Leonard. And what a buzz pollinator means is that they don't really have to get into the flower itself, that they're so big that they cause so much turbulence with their wings that the pollen flies all the way around and it gets into the flower without even touching the flower.
So Gerard, what happens if we kill off the bees? Will we still have pollination?
Well, there's a real big problem, and I'm not the expert on beekeeping, but we do have hives at Grow NYC, and I've been talking to master beekeepers like David Graves from Union Square and Lenny Labrizi out in Staten Island. This year was really tough winter. March played a lot of havoc on a lot of the hives. 90% of David Graves' hives, he told me, were killed off, and he has many hives on the rooftops here in New York City. He owns Berkshire Berries. Lenny Labrizi's out on Staten Island, and he lost many of his hives as well. Now, there are a couple of reasons for that. As we said earlier, and as you said, Leonard, previous shows, neonicotinoids and pesticides that Pete just mentioned. There's also a mite, the Varroa mite that attacks the bees. We have two hives on a rooftop in Long Island City at a community garden at Hunters Point South, and we lost the one hive that was sourced from Pennsylvania. The source of bees from Georgia is still alive in its second year, and we're expecting to harvest about 50 pounds of honey from that hive. So, you know, the bees are endangered. We know that. They're on the endangered list, although they were, as I understand, the bumblebee as well.
Right.
But because of all these issues, and Penn State did a study where they also thought that cell phone towers had an effect on knocking out the radar system of the bees getting back to the hive. So between pesticides and cell phone towers and the Varroa mites, our bees and honeybees are in danger. So the more people can learn about raising bees in their backyard or have them in their community garden, the better it is for our environment.
Climate change, too, is playing a big role. I mean, you look at what happened this winter. It's kind of a picture of what happened the winter before. I mean, February was warm, and then things thought, okay, here comes spring. March got very cold again. We got down to 10 above zero with 2 feet of snow, and that put a lot of bees in a vulnerable situation. And then it got wet again. So this whole up and down, back and forth with the weather is also playing havoc on a lot of the wild bees.
Right, and we if people want to take a trip out to Governor's Island, you know, we're developing a demonstration garden and we have a teaching garden out there. And backyard gardeners, your listeners can put in butterfly and bee gardens, pollinator gardens, rain gardens. These are things that can help the bees and the pollinators. Planting things like Monarda, Coreopsis, things that butterflies can drink from, bees can collect nectar and pollen from. This will all help the bee colonies if you want to do something in your backyard.
My guests are Gerard Lordahl, the director of Open Space Greening Program at Grow NYC, and Pete Morosky, the founder and owner of Native Landscapes Incorporated from Pawling, New York. And we are inviting your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. You were mentioning the variations in weather. We had some heavy snows this winter, and then we had warm days in February. There's been a lot of temperature variation this spring. Today is a perfect example. Last weekend was really warm. Mm-hmm. Today is kind of chilly. Does the heat one day and the cold the next take a toll?
It really did. I could just say for community gardeners, we were out in early May when the temperature reached above 90 degrees. We had record temperatures before Mother's Day. And many people jumped the gun. And not only were they planting their cold season edibles like kale and cabbage and collards, but they also thought with that 90 degree 2 days of 90-degree weather, they would put in things like basil and their peppers and tomatoes. Then we got a cold snap, and we were out in the gardens covering our cool season crops with protection. Because
that's the only
of those
way
cold
you
evenings.
Combat it?
Yeah, you would come out and put protective cloth over the plant material or anything to keep them insulated from that below 50 degree night temperature. But then we got a cold snap and a lot of that warm season stuff like basil was injured.
So the plants get confused, really. It did. Last year we lost a lot of pit fruits in upstate New York.
Exactly.
We have peaches and apricots. Because they started coming out and then they were killed off by the frost.
There was a frost right around Valentine's Day that year, and many of the peach farmers, at that critical moment when the flower was vulnerable to frost, we did get a frost and they lost
that. Are we going to have that problem again today?
Well, you know, Gerard and I were talking about this out in the lobby, and, you know, what's being affected this year, and I think the jury's still out on a lot of plants, is like I got a massive magnolia in front of my mm-hmm. house, and this is the second year in a row where it started to come out in late February and March, and then once again we got some cold weather and it just shriveled right up. So being this close to the Atlantic Ocean, you know, plants like gradual change, you know. I mean, it's a lot different than being in the Rocky Mountains where, you know, one day could be 10 below zero and the next day could be 80 degrees. Plants don't like that here on the East Coast.
Well, they have indigenous plants there that are used to that because that is the ecology of that area.
But that's mm-hmm. not the ecology of the East Coast. This is much different than we're accustomed to, and these plants are really getting affected by that, and it's going to be interesting to see what direction they head in the future because of all this climate change.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, maybe you can suggest some of the plants that will endure better. We have people calling in. Our number here is 212-433-9692. Some people have written in, and I have a really interesting question from a community gardener that I'm going to pose right after we come back. My guests are Pete Morosky, the founder and owner of Native Landscapes Incorporated of Pawling, New York, and Gerard Lordahl, the director of Open Space Greening Program at Grow NYC. Our number again, 212-433-9692. We're talking about gardening and related matters with Gerard Lordahl, the director of Open Space Greening Program at Grow NYC, and Pete Morosky, the founder and owner of Native Landscapes Incorporated, Pawling, New York. That's just north of the city. Our number here is 212-433-9692. If you want to join in the conversation, you can also write to us on our show page at WNYC.org. And somebody wrote in, this is a little long, but Gerard, I think, is right up your alley. My community garden has been invaded by a plant identified as birthwort, Aristolochia. The roots are deep and run far. They also break easily, making many potential new plants from all the broken pieces left behind. Do you have experience with terminating this plant? Additionally, there are rumors of birthwort being used for medicinal purposes. I'm curious whether there are advantages to this monster, although I'm not personally willing to experiment.
Yeah, Aristolochia, I mean, it is a very difficult weed to control, but I don't often recommend any kind of medicinal use of these plants because it could be dangerous and people's sensitivity can
So how do you get rid of them? If you pull them out, do you have to put vinegar there or something like that?
You got to go deep. You got to go deep into the soil. You got to get it, the base of the root. You got to get it from its source. You just got to work it until it's out of there.
And there are many of these weeds that we deal with. That Japanese knotweed is another one. Poison ivy, we're plagued with all sorts of weeds that unless you remove the roots, you're not going to really eradicate them. And we don't want to use toxic chemicals because that could kill off a lot of your good plant material. A very simple suggestion sometimes is just mixing some hydrogen peroxide with some water and soap and spraying that, and that could cause some damage to the weed and not your other edibles.
Right.
Now, are there ways of identifying which is what's a weed and what's an invasive plant and what isn't? Can I go online?
You can. I mean, but, you know, I was just talking to Pete about purslane. A lot of people think of purslane as a weed, but yet it's edible. You see it in a lot of gourmet restaurants. So, you know, a rose bush can be a weed in an apple orchard. A weed is basically a plant that's growing in the wrong location, that's unwanted. In the vegetable garden, we try to plant in rows so that we could identify what are weeds because the weeds are usually not in rows.
But the weeds also take over and often kill off the plants that we want.
Some do, some don't, you know. And what you want to do is you want to educate yourself on what is a good weed and what isn't a good weed. And it's all about, you know, they have these apps on your cell phone now where if you take a picture of a plant, it'll bring up the type of plant it is. Yeah. And you can identify it that way. But it's all about getting to know the goods from the bad and identifying them and working the goods and working out the bads.
A good suggestion in community gardens, we make weed libraries. We actually pot up weeds and we put them in a display so that people know what lamb's quarters is, what dandelion looks like, what the different weeds look like to make sure they could distinguish the good from the bad. So you could develop a weed library.
And there are some very beautiful weeds that we actually like.
There are.
Having.
You mentioned before, Queen Anne's lace is a beautiful plant and people like it.
Let's take some calls. Holly from Jackson Heights, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. Thank you so much for taking my call. Hi, Pete. Hi, Gerard.
Hi.
I live in Jackson Heights, but I also have a house on the black dirt, which is Orange County, New York. And so I've gotten into gardening up there, and I'm trying to do some gardening here in Jackson Heights in my small co-op. And we have a little patio. It has like three sides. Some gets a lot of sun. One patio gets almost none. The side patio gets like a dappled light there. And I was just wondering if you had recommendations for plants or small shrubs that would work well in that kind of, it's a bit of a microclimate because it's protected.
Now, how big is this space? Can you give me a little bit more dimensions?
Dimensions. Let's see. Well, let's say the back patio is probably, let me see, the size of a, you know, like a regular backyard. I don't know. I'm not good with feet.
So you have some space.
Right. So
yeah, there's definitely space to plant.
Right. So you can go with, you know, and I'm a big fan today, and I know Gerard is, of more of an edible landscape, to bring in stuff into the garden that maybe you can enjoy not only to look at, but also that you can eat some of the stuff that comes from these plants. Like in more of the sunny locations, what you might want to go with is like a ground cover like strawberry rather than vinca or pachysandra. And then in the back, you might want to go for elderberry, which is a nice shrub. The beach plum. Yeah, elderberry, the native elderberry. The beach plum, the pawpaw tree. Amelanchier, which is the shad blow.
By the way, I have to tell you, I've had pawpaw ice cream, and it's absolutely delicious. I'm amazed that we haven't cultivated more pawpaw trees. It's a native, indigenous to the area, and when the first Europeans came here, they fell in love with it. But It's pretty much gone.
Well, it's not. They're starting to propagate it again, Leonard. It's a tough plant to propagate. It's a very slow grower. We got a bunch of it at the garden center, and I'm starting to see more and more growers get into it. It's a great fruit. It's loaded with vitamin C. It's one of the bigger native fruits that you can find, and like you said, it's very good for you. And I'm a Gerard. I'm a big fan of this whole edible landscape now. Mm-hmm. You know,
well, lettuce too. Things like that.
Sure, lettuce, radishes. Instead of using annuals in your garden, if you got a little space and it's a little bit sunny, you know, bring in radishes, bring in carrots. Carrots, I mean, the tops of carrots, to me, are very ornamental. And
right.
Then next thing you know, you got a vegetable.
And she mentioned sunlight. So what we recommend is do a sun study. You have to have at least 6 hours of sunlight to grow your fruiting vegetables. 3 hours is shade garden for sure. So there's limitations to what you could put in a shade garden, but certainly things like parsley and the lettuces, the leafy vegetables, can go where there's less sunlight. But if you want your tomatoes, your zucchini, your peppers, go in areas and plant those plants in areas where you have 6 hours or more of sunlight, and that's a good way to start.
And you
also
want,
make sure you have good soil.
Right, and you want to go with plants that are tough too. You don't want to be a slave to what you're putting in a garden. So, you know, things like ferns. I think ferns are some of the most, in a shade garden, some of the most beautiful plants you can put in. You know, the Christmas fern mm-hmm. stays low, the cinnamon ferns. I mean, there's a lot of different stuff that can be done. And, you know, just go online and Google some of this stuff, and you'll find a nice little niche
good luck,
for your garden.
Is that where you recommend we purchase these things? Because that was the second part of the question. Is I know, like, the Home Depot and you know, places like that don't really sell these lesser.
There are reputable places online. You know, you might want to Google for, you know, organic heirloom varieties that are very special. But you want to go with a garden center that's reputable. You don't want insects or pests brought back to your yard or your house. So, you know, check online. But there are lots of sources of good plant material.
But when I go to garden shops or to Home Depot and the like, I'm stunned by how much space is taken up by pesticides and fertilizers. Do we need all of them?
Not at all, Leonard. And it's all about getting to know the right plant for the right location. If you do companion right. planting around your house, if you plant clethra with winterberry holly, with these plants that have the same cultural recommendations and you know, then you're not going to have so many problems with pests. You know, it's the right plant in the right location. You don't want to plant a rhododendron on top of a mountain where you can see the Catskills from your house, because it'll just get blown apart. The right plant in the right location will keep your pesticides down. And then, you know, that even goes with lawns. You know, there's no need to have all these lawn chemicals, you know. Biodiversity is fine in a lawn. I mean, I love the fact that I got violets growing in my lawn and I got all this little stuff. It's almost like a mini perennial garden in my lawn. And let the lawns grow up a little bit high. Don't mow them so short.
But some people are upset by the fact that the United States has 40 million acres of lawn and between the lawn and the pavement, it covers 5.5 times the size of New Jersey.
Well, the problem is people are putting all these chemicals on these lawns, and they're using up a lot of water that really isn't necessary. So lawns are very high maintenance. And, you know, we suggest to people to replace your lawn with a drought-tolerant rain garden or a butterfly garden or a pollinator garden. And the 500 or so community gardens in the city do not use pesticides at all. Save the health of your family and your pets. Don't put any chemicals on your lawn. You know, we do a lot of integrated pest management where you're using biological control. If you have aphids, well, you could release ladybugs. There are a lot of insects that will eat other insects. There are cultural things that you can do. Don't leave standing water around. That attracts insects. Make sure you rotate your crop, and that will prevent diseases from happening in the garden. Right now on a rooftop, we turn mason jars sideways and we put sand and grit inside to attract the slugs and the snails that are eating the hosta. And there are all sorts of organic controls that you can do.
It kills
that don't
the snails?
Require pests. Yeah, they're attracted to stale beer in the mason jar, and they don't like snails and slugs have a very mucilaginous skin, and they can't walk on anything sharp like sand Or you might have heard of diatomaceous earth, which is crushed diatoms from the ocean. These are ways to control slugs and snails in the garden. They also are attracted to stale beer. You put it in a recessed pie plate, and the slugs and snails are attracted to it, and they drown.
You can also use grasses that don't grow very high, like carex. You know, carex is a grass that only grows 6 or 8 inches tall, and if you did a carex lawn, you never even have to mow it. You know, it kind of self-sows itself, and it stays that way throughout the growing season.
I'm speaking with Pete Murawski, the founder and owner of Native Landscapes Incorporated, Pauling, New York, and Gerard Lordahl, the director of the Open Space Greening Program at Grow NYC. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. We go now to, is it Aslahan?
Yes.
Hi, Aslahan. Hi. Linden, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, how are you? My question concerns transforming a suburban lawn, a boring suburban lawn, into a haven for native plants and wildlife, and specifically sweat bees, because they're beautiful and adorable.
Right, so what you want to do is let the lawn grow up and let it become a little bit wild. You can even, if you wanted to do like a low wildflower meadow, you can till the lawn in and then spread a wildflower seed and let the wildflower seed plants grow. And next thing you know, you got a wildflower meadow in your front yard. And we do that a lot. A lot of it is all about timing. You know, this wildflower seed can be a little bit expensive. So what you want to do is you want to time it so that you get the most germination. And a lot of times that's the fall. So you got a little bit of time to think about the type of soils you have, the type of exposure you have. Is it sunny? Is it shady? And bring in seeds that thrive in that particular environment. And guess what? It's a quality of life thing. You know, you don't have to put up bird feeders anymore. You look out on your front lawn and all these butterflies and hummingbirds are going to come to your wildflower meadow, which was once your lawn.
Let's see. Go
the
ahead.
The thing is, the local laws about lawn, you know, care and cutting the grass, and they don't really let you let your grass grow longer than a few inches. And how do you get around those laws?
Well, that's interesting.
You move.
Yeah, I think some of those laws need to be changed a little bit. And I think people like you who have the knowledge and the background, and if you approach your towns and say, this is what I want to do, and this is more environmentally friendly than a lawn, how could they say no to you?
And, you know, you could start simply by thinking about a kidney-shaped perennial garden or native plants in a kidney-shaped planting within your lawn. You don't have to get overwhelmed and think, oh, I have to remove my entire lawn this year. But you could gradually, as Pete's suggesting, plant natives in like some kind of a planting bed and slowly move to reduce the amount of water and chemicals you're putting on your lawn.
And reduce the size of your lawn. Make the lawn smaller and make the perennial wildflower meadow creep in so that maybe you can, work around the rules.
Now, it's vacation time is coming up. A lot of people are going to be going away, and a listener called to find out what's the best way to take care of your plants while you're away. This is especially true for people who live in apartments and have plants on their windowsill.
There's all sorts of innovative ways to use wicks and things like that to cover plants with clear plastic bags if you're gone. People will put their ferns in the bathroom in a tub filled with a small amount of water. They will cover their plantings with plastic to retain moisture if they're away on the terrace. They'll put up windbreakers to cut down things that will desiccate their plants while they're away. So there are a lot of innovative things you can do. Mulching is very important, adding compost or creating a layer, a protective layer on top of the soil, because exposed soil dries out so fast. So adding compost to the outdoor garden will help. Putting in an irrigation system on a timer is not that expensive. It's not that difficult. Many community gardens and rooftop gardens have timed irrigation systems that make sure the moisture gets to the roots when needed. So those would be some of the suggestions. And using plants like Pete's suggesting that are drought tolerant, native, that will do well in your area.
And these, we should get into the rooftop and terrace gardens a little bit, because I know insurance companies are talking a little bit about this, that, you know, we have very windy conditions, and the last thing they want to see a lot of these containers flying off the roof and down into the streets. So you want to use containers that are heavy, that are bolted down, and that have some weight to them, you know, maybe a little bit of gravel on the bottom so that they stay put on these rooftop gardens, because the last thing we need is is a liability issue on these rooftop gardens when it comes to planters and wind.
Joe from Queens, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, my name's Joe Butera, and I'm president and co-founder of the Northeast Ecological Recovery Society, which is a conservation organization dedicated to restoring native species to the Northeast. And I just wanted to say to your viewers, if they could just plant milkweed for the monarch butterflies, because
we're going to get to that.
Monarch butterflies are species-specific. They need monarch to... in order to lay their eggs. And I've been in touch with the city for 5 years, and it's very difficult to try and get them not to mow milkweed along the roads. And it just breaks my heart every spring and every summer when I'm driving up to Cross Island or the LIE or 87, I see these beautiful milkweeds getting cut down by, the lawnmowers there. And it's not their fault. It's just miscommunication. And I also was a beekeeper for 25 years, so...
You don't bees like milkweed?
And there are a lot of plants that, you know, we saw stands of black locust that the honeybee really loves. And unfortunately for affordable housing, that black locust stand had to go. But so that's why it's important, because these insects that are so much needed in the city need to find other habitats. That's why your backyard, your perennial garden, your rain garden, your pollinator garden are so important. You know, not just a lawn, but something that the insects can benefit from.
And native milkweed is very important. He was mentioning about the milkweed growing on the side of the road. A lot of people plant exotic or tropical milkweed in their garden. And a lot of times, the monarch butterfly doesn't know the difference. They'll come into cocoon on an exotic type milkweed, but they're just not getting the nutritional value they get from the native milkweed, and the cocoon just kind of shrivels up and dies. So
we're pretty much out of time, but I did want to ask one more question. How do you know if the soil is right for planting edible things?
Well, you know, it always starts with a soil test for local gardeners. Have your soil tested for pH. Make sure the texture is correct. A good combination is equal parts sand, silt, clay, and compost or organic matter. It's called a nice loam. So if you go online and look at the definition of a good loamy soil, L-O-A-M-Y, that would give you a good start.
Stay away from synthetics. Go all natural. Leaf mold, any of this stuff that's very natural, slow-release fertilizer, that's the direction you want to go.
We've run out of time, unfortunately.
I just want to say, if people want information, go to grownyc.org. You could download a lot of gardening information to your listeners.
My great thanks to both of you for being on our show again. Gerard Lordahl is the director of the Open Space Greening Program at Grow NYC. Pete Murawski is the founder and owner of Native Landscapes Incorporated of Pawling, New York. Although you're all over the area, aren't you?
Yeah, we have no limitations.
It's been a lot of fun talking with you.
Thanks,
Leonard. Thank you, Leonard.